We will do all of that. But this is all about, I mean, we have an amazing president right now in Washington. In many ways, he's the most amazing political leader I've seen in Washington, where I've been living now for 27 years. And we've had three of them, actually, just like him, more or less like him, since the end of the Second World War. And it's all the same. It's the same pattern over and over again. They are people who are not intellectuals, who are not cultured, who do not have experience, who have not traveled, who do not speak foreign languages, all of this, but who understand very well because they have a spontaneous bonding with the American people, and they know what, how Americans feel and what Americans want, and they become the expression of that, and they have unerring instincts on foreign policy. And it's something almost magical. I don't know really how to explain it, but we've had three of them now: Harry Truman, Ronald Reagan, and George W. Bush. And it's the same phenomenon each time, and the world always reacts the same way toward these people. They say, well, you know, what a shame that such a great country has to have such an idiot for a president. And how can you take seriously a person who mispronounces words and makes up words, like strategery and things like that? I don't think that many people in the Middle East are laughing about the mispronunciation of strategery today, because he knows what he's about, and he's serious about what he's doing, as were Reagan and Truman, right? And it's the same thing. So that somehow or other, President Bush understood immediately after September 11th that the war against terrorism was a war against tyranny, and that to defeat terrorism, democracy was the solution. And that, yes, here and there we were going to have to use military power, not everywhere. Different countries called for different solutions. But at the end of the action, the way to win the war was to spread the democratic revolution through all those countries which were supporting terrorism, because that is what they most fear. And he's very serious about this. And I would counsel you, because I've learned it myself at first hand, if you want to understand what's going on in Washington, don't watch the evening news. Don't read the newspapers. Just listen to what the president says. I can't begin to tell you how many times inside Washington has failed to anticipate what this administration was going to do. And they've always failed to understand it when they ignored what the president said. This president has been unbelievably consistent. And one can criticize him, and I do, for taking too long sometimes. I think we took much too long to get from Afghanistan to Iraq. All right. And I think if we had done it faster, we wouldn't have had many of the problems that we had. We would have had most of the world in favor instead of most of the world against. We would have not had the internal problems that we had. We would have kept the pot boiling in the region, which was important. But all right, he got there. And when it was all over, he said to the Iraqi people, he said, now you know that we mean what we say and that we're going to do what we say. And the Iranian leaders know that too. So where are they now? I mean, imagine yourself to be Rafsanjani or Khamenei or whoever your favorite devil may be. And you're sitting there. You're sitting there and you have Afghanistan on one side, and you have Iraq on the other, and you have in Iraq the greatest instrument for democracy of the 20th century, namely the United States Army, and you're scared. They're scared. I mean, look at how Rafsanjani is behaving. I mean, this tough guy, the guy who said that America's going into a quagmire in Iraq, that it's going to be Vietnam all over again, and that we will rue the day that we ever set foot in Iraq, and it's going to be a long, bloody war, and so forth. Well, you know, if the French hadn't blackmailed the Turkish opposition parties, the war would have taken 2 weeks instead of 3 weeks. It took 3 weeks because we were unable to come down from the north as well, so we had to sail all the way around and do all these parachute landings and so forth. Very annoying. Okay, so it took 3 weeks. He sees that. They all see it. And so they see an irresistible power on the one hand. They see a freed Afghanistan on the other. They know democracy is coming to Iraq. Yes, they're going to do everything they can to stop it. They've put thousands of terrorists inside Iraq. Many of them are dead already. Others will die in the weeks ahead. Some of them will kill our people. And they are trying to repeat in Najaf and Karbala the same strategy that they used to bring down the Shah in 1979. It's exactly the same thing. They're trying to... Well, it is. I mean, it's wonderful. If you look at the pictures of the of these so-called spontaneous demonstrators, the Shiites carrying all these banners, very thoughtfully and considerately written, both in Arabic and in English, in Arabic for the people and in English for CNN and the other television networks. If you look at it, what really dazzles you is how beautifully clean these banners are and how wonderfully professional is the lettering. And you have to ask yourself, I mean, here's a country that was already in misery before the war, which has now been bombed and shelled and marched over and so forth. Somehow, someone very considerately saved miles of fabric on which to write these things, and then now all they have to do. Right, right, so it's obvious. And, you know, we're slow in Washington, it's true. I mean, democracy is a very messy, very sloppy, very slow process, maddeningly slow, and unbelievably messy. But we're not stupid, and we get there. And the nice thing about, I'm going to have to tell you, the nice thing about being a superpower is that you have a greater margin for error. So you can make mistakes, and you can take longer to get there, and you can still recover, because we have this enormous power of every sort. And what the tyrants never understand about the United States, it's the same mistake that every opponent we had in the 20th century made over and over and over again. And it's really astonishing that people have not figured it out. That is, they do not understand the unbelievable power that a free people has when it mobilizes together to solve a common problem and confront a common threat. And the Japanese and the Germans really believed that with Pearl Harbor, they would knock us out of the war and we would not be able to get back into it until it was too late. Just as Osama bin Laden and the whole network of terrorist countries believed that with September 11th, they would so frighten us and so shatter us and so break our nerve and our morale that they would be able to have their way first in the Middle East and then elsewhere. And they were totally wrong. Because the only thing they accomplished when they attacked the United States is not to make us afraid, but to make us angry. And it's dangerous to make the United States angry, very dangerous. And there's a long list of people who you can ask about how dangerous it is to anger the United States. What the United States now sees, and even those who did not want to see it, who desperately did not want to see it, and there are many of those, always, now see Iran pouring into Iraq to do everything possible to prevent a free and democratic Iraq from coming into being. And they see it. We all see it. I mean, you cannot fail to see it. It's just, it's there. And yes, American intelligence, contrary to legend, isn't very good. Not very good. We haven't had people for years and years. If you've read my book, The War Against the Terror Masters, you will find that as of September 10th, 2001, we did not have, so far as I know, a single case officer in Iran, Iraq, or Lebanon. Not one, not a single one. And so it's very hard, given that, to have an appreciation of all the details and the subtleties going on in a country as complicated as Iran. And Iran is a wonderfully complicated country. Terrific to study. I mean, my field is not Middle East, but Italy. Italy is the country I know best. And I have a kind of spontaneous understanding of Iran because Iran is sort of Italy one step further. I mean, Italy is terrifically complicated and clever and baroque and imaginative and full of deceit and cunning and wonderful stories and fantasies. And Iran is even more so. But I mean, but it's the same model. You know, it's nothing to applaud. It's the nature of Mediterranean civilization, of which Iran is a part and of which Italy is a part. I mean, they have a common pattern. But when the United States really focuses down on an area of the world because our guys are there and they are at risk and we don't want anything to happen to them, we really do see everything that moves and we really do hear everybody who whispers. And we are now seeing everyone who moves and we are hearing everyone who whispers. And we know. So we see Iran doing this now. And Rafsanjani and Khamenei and all the rest of them know that. But they have to do it because they're desperate, because they know that their people hate them, because they know that their allies are also in line. They know that the terror network that they supported for so many years is now in grave jeopardy and that we are coming after them. And if Syria falls, then if Syria goes and Lebanon is freed, where will Hezbollah go to live? And where will the various Palestinian terrorist organizations train? I mean, they were training in Syria, Lebanon, and Iraq for the most part. Well, Iraq is gone. Syria is equally terrified along with Iran, and they are suddenly closing their borders and pretending to be law-abiding citizens. What will happen? So they must now fight us in Iraq. There's no escape for them because they're doomed and they might as well go for it right now. So they're going for it right now. Right, moral for you, for the Iranian people. Now is the time. Now is the moment at which this regime is at its most exposed, at its most vulnerable. Their self-confidence has been shattered. Every forecast they made about the way the war would go in Iraq has been proven false. Everything they said to themselves, above all to themselves, but also to the Iranian people, about the weakness of the United States, about the indecisiveness of the United States, about the inability of American soldiers to fight hand to hand and face to face, all of that has now been destroyed. And the Iranian people know it. So now is the time to fill those squares, to shut down the oil business, to shut down the textile companies, to close the schools, to close the universities, and to say to the regime, it's over, go away, get out of here. Now, if you've read my stuff, I have been pleading with the American government now for over a year to support democratic forces in Iran. And when I sit down and talk to them in Washington and say, why are we not doing this? Why are the Iranian people less worthy than the Filipinos or the Yugoslavs or the Poles and the Hungarians? Why are we not doing this? For the most part, the answer, they don't say it exactly in this way, the answer is we don't know exactly who to support. Suppose we gave you $10 million, who would you support? Because we don't see a leader, we don't see to whom we're supposed to give this. And it's a fair comment. And I know a lot of you say the same things to yourself. Well, and the answer is that this kind of comment comes from people who don't understand how democracy and how democratic revolution works. Because you never see them at this phase. You only see them once it gets going. And they are there. We know they're there. Because if they weren't there, these demonstrations wouldn't happen. If they weren't there, you couldn't have a million people in downtown Tehran demonstrating and hundreds of thousands of demonstrators starting at the university sometimes, but then spreading through the rest of the city. And people standing out in the streets in silent vigils and people flooding the streets carrying candles. So we know that it comes from someplace, and we know that the leaders are there. We do not know who they are. To which I say, and thank God we don't know who they are. Because if we knew who they are, the rulers would know who they are and they'd be dead. But we will find out who they are once we start to support them, because then they will emerge. In any case, the channels exist. We know what the organizations look like, at least enough of them to start the process moving, and we know what they need. They need, first and foremost, money, because they need to go out in the streets, and to go out in the streets, they have to be able to say to their wives and children, here is money for a month. So if I'm arrested, here's food for a month, here's heat for a month, this will keep you going. They need instruments of communication, satellite telephones, and all the rest of the apparatus that so that they can coordinate between one city and another. And they know how to use these things. I mean, all of us know how amazing the communication is from Iran to here, on internet, by phone cards, by cell phones, all kinds of different ways, and all the tricks that they have used now to cheat the regime, to stop people from finding out who they are and how they're calling and so forth. And this brings me to my final point, which is where I started about my own country and where I'm going to end with yours. And that is, help will come from the United States government, but it will come most quickly and most efficiently when the United States government sees plainly what is going on and a real thing for them to support. And that's for you to do. The Iranian diaspora is one of the richest diasporas in history. Few communities have ever left a country, gone overseas, turned themselves around, and enriched themselves as have Iranians. Above all in the United States, in unbelievably wealthy communities in California, in Massachusetts, in New York, I discovered recently in Minnesota, something which I hadn't even known. Senator Coleman informed me about it, right? Countless wealth. Even if there is no particular tradition of philanthropy in the Iranian diaspora, in the sense of sending money back home to support the people back home, surely there's enough business sense to realize that if you invest $10 million today in the future of Iran, you will get $10 billion back within a very few years. I mean, any person with a business head on his shoulders has to know that this is one of the best investments in the world today. Invest in the future of Iran. Support democratic forces in your home country. I mean, you can hardly do better than that, right? So as you contemplate the future of Iran, think first about how to organize the Iranian community and the diaspora to raise the money that's needed for Iranians in Iran to stage the kind of democratic revolution that we all know can succeed and will succeed. And the only thing that's lacking is the wherewithal, a bit of money, not even a lot of money. And I wrote someplace that if the Iranian community in the Western world behaved the way the Jewish community in the Western world behaves, Iran would have been free 10 years ago. And you can free it any time. It's lying there, ready to be taken. It's begging you to take it back. And now you have a young country with a young generation of people who are actively studying democracy. That is what they are most passionately studying. That's another revelation to me. Because I talk to lots of people who go to Iran to teach in Iranian schools on exchange programs and so forth. These programs exist. And all of them come back and say, it's amazing. They're all studying the American Constitution. They're reading the great documents of American political thought. They're doing comparative constitutional studies. They're comparing the American Constitution with British common law, with the French Constitution, and so on. That's what they're doing. They're getting ready because they all know that it's coming. All right. So you must have faith in these people. You have to support these people. It has to come from you. You are the ones who owe them this. You were the ones who were driven out and came here hoping to find a better life, and you found a better life. To conserve it for yourselves here and not do anything to liberate this generation of Iranians is really a kind of betrayal, isn't it? You need to help them. And you need to do other things as well, at least for a while. Like all emigre communities, the Iranian emigre community is terribly divided. There are factions on everything. right? There's parties within parties. There's sects within groups. Everybody wants to have the instrument for speaking to the Iranian people. Lots of different radio stations, a couple of different television stations. Each, you know, I talk to everybody. I refuse, it's not my game. I'm not going to play this game. So what I have always done is anybody who calls me up and says, I broadcast to Iran, I talk to them. I talk to everybody. And I hope you will forgive me when I say to you that every one of you that I have talked to has always said, I'm the real one, don't talk to those other people. Yeah. Right? All right? Well, okay. Time for that particular game is also over. And it's time for you to forget that kind of competition because, I mean, suppose you win. Then what? Suppose you are the only one. And then? I mean, that's not what's at stake here. This is big-time game. We're talking about freedom for an entire country, 70 million people. And we're talking about the crucial blow in the war against terrorism. If we don't bring down Iran and this regime survives and they somehow manage to wiggle their way out of the situation in the Middle East, we will get another September 11th. Worse, much worse. And it'll keep happening over and over again until finally this thing is brought down. Because we all know that Iran is the mother of international terrorism. It's the greatest proof. So please forget about internal competition. It's time for unity. It's time to get yourselves together. And it's time to get yourselves together here, and it is time then to have your representatives, some of them, come to Washington permanently and sit there and talk to the government. Government has to hear from you. It's not enough for them to hear from me. I don't have the same standing. You speak firsthand. You speak Farsi. I don't. You're on the phone to people in Iran every day. I'm not. I can't speak with the same authority that you can. You have to be there. You have to talk to the leaders of the executive branch and the leaders of the legislature. You have to sit on them. And you can't let these various senators, whether they're Republicans or Democrats, and they're on both sides, who somehow have gotten confused about what's going on in Iran. And you can't let the Deputy Secretary of State stand up and say Iran is a democracy and let him get away with it. All right? So you have to be there. So you have to unite yourselves here. You have to get yourselves an office in Washington. It doesn't have to be anything glorious or fancy. It's very hard work. It's very frustrating. You have to do it. And above all, you have to get among yourselves and you have to raise yourself several million dollars and get it to the people in Iran. And if you, I can't imagine, but if you're in any doubt as to how it should go or where it should go, call me up and I'll tell you where to send it. So you can send it, right? I'm not, you know, I don't want it. I know who will use it best. And tell the people that you go to raise the money from, we don't need it all at once. I mean, probably the real number that's necessary to free Iran today, the top number is probably $20 million. I think you can buy yourself a free Iran right now for $20 million. And you can say to the people to whom you go to get this money, don't give it to us all at once. You don't have to believe it all. Test it. Give us five and watch what happens. And if you're satisfied with what happens, then give us another five and another five and another five. So as long as the people inside see the first tranche, start to act, and know that as they succeed, more support will come to them, they will do it, and it will succeed. And then we will really be in a position to have a great party. The other night, you know, the American Enterprise Institute, all these years, has supported Ahmad Chalabi and the Iraqi National Congress in the face of the most violent opposition from most of the world. And Ahmed called the other night and he said, okay, come to dinner in Baghdad, we're ready for you. And I said to him, no, no, no. I said, we're gonna come for a week And we're going to spend the first half of the week in Baghdad and the second half of the week in Tehran. So you're going to have to wait a little bit longer. So that's my sermon. So thank you very much, and I'll be happy to answer your questions. Fine, just call me.
Sure.
We'd like to conclude this evening's presentation with questions and answers. So if you have any questions or questions that you would like Dr. Ladin to answer, please stand up, raise your hand, speak clearly, and we'll point at you, and one by one you can ask your questions, okay? Time is limited, so please keep your questions short, okay? Yes, ma'am. Dr. Ladin.
Big article, you haven't read it. The Newsweek of this week has actually gotten this article that gives us a great deal of information about, just like you said, how the Islamic Republic is planning to, has a grand plan inside of Iraq. What is to say that they're not going to do the same thing they did in Lebanon in 1983? And how's the United States going to stop that? And then my second question is, what is the United States going to do, in your opinion, to reinstate the item of human rights violations in Iran and put it back on the agenda of the Human Rights Committee?
Well, to tell you, I haven't read Newsweek, although I have great respect for Newsweek. I think that Newsweek has done really very good work, particularly on terrorism, where they're unbeatable. The question of Iran on the human rights agenda is we're trying now. I mean, Jean Kirkpatrick is the American delegate to the UN Human Rights Commission in Geneva right now, and she has been trying to get Iran on the agenda. So we will continue to try to do that. As to the question of will they try to repeat the Lebanon strategy of the 1980s in Iraq today, the answer is yes, absolutely. That's what they will try to do. And Bashar Assad said so 2 weeks ago, gave an interview in which he said the model is Lebanon. So that's precisely what they will try to do. How will we defeat them? We will try to get them before they get us. And we're not, right now, we are much more committed to solving the regional problem than we were in 1983. And we should have done it in 1983, right? We've had many chances to do it. We could have done it in 1983. We never should have stopped in 1991 when we had the road to Baghdad wide open. Could have done it right then and there, should have done it right then and there. There are many occasions when we should have done it. We should have responded after the first bombing of the World Trade Center, right? And we didn't do it. I mean, we made plenty of mistakes. I lived in Italy for 11 years, and I've been working in Italy for the better part of 35 years. And if you spend enough time in Italy, you come to realize that God put man on earth to make mistakes, because that's mostly what we do. So we've made a lot of mistakes. But now we're there. And they will try it, and I have every confidence that they will fail, because we have absolutely winning strategies right now. Barry, I would much rather be in my position than their position right now.
My name is Shahryar Dolatabadi. I have two-part question. One part regard the Iraq situation, and second, that my question is first, a few weeks before the Iraq war, on ABC, Nightline, there was a program regarding Project 77H that many ultra conservative put their name and signature on that paper. And the start of this program was Iraq. Then Iran, Libya, Syria, Arabistan, Saudi, and on. Would you kindly comment about that? And second question, one vote, one person. Every individual in Iraq has right to vote. 68% are Shia. Tomorrow, after General Gordon finished his job, free election, 68% in Iraq vote, we want a regime as Iran. What would be the response of United States?
Okay,
thank you very much.
I understand. The about this famous document, I've never seen it, so it's very hard for me to comment on it. And yet, I'm always taken to be one of the people who drafted that document and so forth. I've never read it. And in any case, I will tell you that in Washington, you can find any document you wish, on any position you wish, on any issue that you wish, because there's always a group of people somewhere in Washington that believes everything about something. So what? Suppose there were a document and signed by all these infamous neoconservatives. Suppose it exists. It may even exist. I mean, no one has ever accused George Bush, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, George Tenet of being neoconservatives, nor did they sign this document. These are the people making the decisions, Condoleezza Rice, Stephen Hadley, you name it, you go through it. It's really time for people to stop thinking in terms of conspiracies. The United States is not governed by conspiracy. I often wish it were, if only I could become a member of the governing conspiracy. It would be great, because then you just say things, all right, do this, do that. It's much easier, instead of having to debate every issue every day and fighting your way through all the mess that constitutes a modern democratic society. It just doesn't work that way. So forget that. I mean, that has nothing to do with the way America works. As for the Shiites in Iraq, so far as I know, the number is 60%, not 68. I've never heard 68 from anybody. I think it's 60. The history of the Shiite faith, as distinct from the Sunni faith, is that it is a sacrilege for there to be religious governance of civil society before the disappeared imam returns. That is to say, there has to be separation. I mean, the tradition of the Shiite faith is that there's separation of mosque and state until messianic days, as we would call it in the West. So that in a peculiar way, it has always seemed to me that the greatest hope for Islam becoming a modern faith and adapting itself to the requirements of modern society is Shiism. I mean, if you're going to worry about the future of Islam, I mean, Shiism is the best chance. The Sunnis are terribly involved in all of this caliphate business and all the nonsense that Osama bin Laden talks about all the time. Shiites, not. What's going on now in Iraq is a great war for the hearts and minds of the Iraqi Shiite community. The Iranians fear that if the Iraqi Shiites are left to their own devices, that instead of calm dominating Najaf and Karbala, that it will be Najaf and Karbala that will dominate Iran. Far from being confident of dominating Iraq and far from moving in to Najaf and Karbala with the tone of, you know, dominating masters and giving orders to the Iraqi people, this is a war of desperation on their part. It's very different from the way it was. I mean, you have to put yourself in their position and think realistically about the jam that they are in. They are fighting for survival. They are not extending their domination. All these moves on their part are moves of desperation. So that's the situation they're fighting. If you listen to Rumsfeld this morning, there was a very tricky question at his press conference. Somebody said, what kind of government will the United States tolerate in Iraq? And Rumsfeld said, we want a democratic government in Iraq. And then the questioner said, well, what about the kind of government that Iran has? Would the United States find that satisfactory. And Rumsfeld said, I certainly would not call the government of Iran democratic. Well, that's the answer to your question. So you don't have to ask these questions.
If you have questions, please come over here to the microphone. Thank you. Dr. Razoyan Befar.
Thank you, sir, for your instructive and lecture. I enjoyed very much. You mentioned, fortunately, you are educated and good writer. Napoleon said the pen is more effective and cutting than the sword.
Yeah, but he said it, but he didn't believe it.
Yeah. Oh, well, that today is. George's father did not succeed because the writer, they did not support him. George's father for the second election, you know that detail. However, I want to bring you to the history of the world. All nations, when they are in trouble, they need some help from outside. United States, your grandfather, they got their freedom by some help from France. France got their democracy in Second World War by getting help from United States. Jewish, they got their help from Cyrus the Great. Cyrus the Great, yes. 2,339 years ago, released the Jewish from Babylonian prison. If he wouldn't let them to make their temple. And so, there would not be any Jewish. Today, please, in your writer, reflect our Iranian request from Jewish community that they have big influence in administration, that they owe to Iranian and also to America that their fault of administration at Carter's time brought this tragedy for Iranian. For these two reasons, we deserve to have some help. Inside of the country, they need help. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I have nothing to say. It's just, you have 80% of the country. Why are you asking for help? What do you want? If the American revolutionaries constituted maybe 20% of the population, they needed help. Right? The Jews are always the tiny. No, it's my turn. The Jews have always constituted a tiny minority.
I apologize. Let's leave this for some other time because time is limited. I apologize. Mr. Okay. Sadiri, please.
My name is Jimmy Sadri. I'm a political activist. I'm an Iranian-American. I'm proud of my Iranian heritage as well as America. I know the census in the White House is the way that you're explaining tonight that the Iranian regime at the present, the Islamic regime, must go. But are they in the same page with the State Department, also with the other functions of the United States government, that they will see in the same page that, yes, it's time for the Iranian regime, which is the Islamic regime, to go? Also, you mentioned at the time that the Russian government fell during the President Reagan, the Americans were giving grain to Russians, were giving help to Russians, technical help, and they decided that the time is now to stop it, and President Reagan was brave and said, let's bring the government to an end, and it happened. Is it time for that time? And the part of the second question that I have is this. It is not only the America. In Iran, we have a saying, if you pull a turban of a mullah, under it is written, made in England.
Yes,
thank you. Thank you. The question is, are the European countries, particularly Great Britain and France, in the same page with the United States policy to bring this regime of terror down from what is going on right now in Iran. Thank you.
Yes, well, you know, this, I know that all Iranians feel that way about Great Britain. I've learned that over the years. We do not feel that way about England, you know. We rather like the English, and that feeling has been reinforced recently when England was quite happy to send English soldiers to fight and die alongside of us in Iraq. So we don't share this. Anyway, the answer to that second question, which is not the important question, the first one is the important question, is who cares? I mean, who cares what the French or the Germans, or if you insist, the English want? I mean, it doesn't matter. The Mediterranean world always believes, it's a feature of the Mediterranean world, that the truth is never what it simply appears to be, because that's too easy. So it must be more complicated. There must always be something behind it that really explains it, and so forth. But, you know, when you have 80% of the country, then you don't need complicated explanations. You have it. So just take it. It's yours. It belongs to you. So just take it. I mean, those numbers, no government can stand against numbers like that. It's just a matter of translating the numbers into reality on the street. Now, your question about, all right, the president understands it and gets it and says the right things and so forth, but what about the State Department? And what about these other places? And this is part of my sermon about democracy. There has never been a time, and there never will be a time, in the United States of America where all the major agencies and bureaus of the United States government agree on anything. That's not the nature of American democracy. The nature of American democracy is that people disagree all the time. And they disagree about everything. And it's a wonderful thing. It's an important thing. Because if they agreed, then the president would be very badly placed in making his decisions. Because if Rumsfeld, Cheney, Tenet, Powell, and Rice all agreed, then the president would never hear the full range of opinions. What the president wants and what a president needs is to hear the whole range of opinions. And he wants to hear arguments. And one of the complaints that I hear from Bush from time to time is that I keep reading in the papers that you people disagree with each other, so why don't you argue in front of me? I don't hear enough of these arguments. I want to hear the arguments. So yes, they will disagree on everything. And that's the way it's supposed to be. But the system is they argue, they dispute, they disagree, the disagreements are brought to the president makes his decision, and that's policy. That's why I said to you, don't get all wrapped up in what does Rumsfeld want? What does Powell want? What does Tenet want? What does Rice think? The president of the United States on foreign policy is the one and only decision maker. He decides. And what he decides is policy. And that's the way it works. So of course there are going to be disagreements, always and forever. At least I hope so. Because the day we stop having disagreements is the day American democracy dies.